Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case this morning is Cochert versus Greater Lafayette Health Services Incorporated.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Miles Zaremski, one of the attorneys for Plaintiff Appellant Carolyn Cochert. The counsel table with me is Alone Stein, and Dr. Carolyn Cochert is in the gallery in the first row. The contracts at issue today, this morning, Your Honors, limit consumer choice and cause consumer injury. The contracts at issue today have harmed competition. Dr. Cochert has shown this through four principal points. The first point is that she has shown market power in the relevant markets, that she has shown adverse effects on consumer welfare, that she has shown that pro-competitive effects do not outweigh the adverse effects caused by the contracts, and that Dr. Cochert has sustained economic loss arising out of the operation of those contracts which have caused harm to competition, resulting in consumer injury. Let me address the first point. That is the markets. The first market is the product. The product is anesthesia services in the markets of obstetrical care and inpatient surgical care. It is not the market of anesthesiologists. In this case, we have developed where Dr. Cochert, through affidavits and deposition testimony, has been requested by patients and colleagues alike. This is not a situation as might have been found in Dos Santos where nobody knows what anesthesiologist they're requesting, a radiologist, but in this case, the record evidence has developed that Dr. Cochert has been requested by patients who require anesthesia services in these two areas. And by the way, we're eliminating the markets of ambulatory care centers because by federal and state law, you cannot obtain those services because they require a greater than 23-hour stay.
Well, isn't one of the big problems you have the fact that Cochert was not in the anesthesia services business when this potentially anti-competitive behavior began? She had already switched her focus. She was not even in the business.
Well, that addresses the issue of standing, Judge Williams.
Right, and standing is something that's critical to proceeding to those further arguments.
Your Honor is correct, but that sort of interconnects with the expert testimony that has been presented in this case, principally through Dr. Bruce Seaman.
But the court had a real problem with that expert testimony because it was pretty narrow and there were other services that were within the vicinity of these entities that were not even included in the survey.
Judge Williams, you're pointing to the area of, is there a suitable alternative to GLHS for services? And if an analysis of alternative services or locations is not done in a case like this, there is a deficiency. But one of Dr. Seaman's opinions was that in his opinion, found relevant and reliable, and I will address the Daubert issues, that found relevant and reliable was that the suitable or the alternatives available in the market were not suitable. And that was an opinion that the lower court found relevant and reliable. And indeed, when we take a look at the Daubert standard that guides this circuit from the trilogy of cases, Daubert, Joyner, and Kumho Tyer, we see that if an opinion is found relevant, it fits a material issue of fact. And indeed, the lower court addressed that specifically by finding that the geographic market is a central issue to this case. Thus, Judge Williams, the expert's opinion is that, and that which was found relevant and reliable, and therefore admissible, was that the market was not these alternatives out there because they were not suitable substitutes. Judge Sharp did...
Yeah, but when we get back to the Daubert ruling, this was just an admissibility ruling, and I agree the court said it was relevant for purposes of the proceeding, but that doesn't mean that the court has to find there's a material fact in dispute just because you meet that preliminary threshold under Daubert.
The two main prongs of Daubert are relevancy and reliability. If a testimony is relevant on a central issue, it is admitted and therefore should have the force to overcome any motion for summary judgment.
But you aren't even able to find any cases that support your theory that just because the court makes that finding of relevance, that of necessity dictates a finding, a rejection of summary judgment because there has to be a material fact. You don't have any authority that goes that far.
Well, indeed, there are no cases in the federal jurisprudence where there's expert testimony found relevant and reliable on controverted facts that haven't been able to withstand summary judgment. Now, this sort of begs the issue of admissibility and sufficiency. We're not saying that admissibility and sufficiency are to be conflated. But what we're saying is that the admissibility standard is sufficiently rigorous that in all practical purposes and almost invariably will be able to say that that testimony is sufficient to go to a jury. Now, that's point number one regarding the fact that there are no cases that in the federal jurisprudence that says precisely what we're saying. But point number two on this, and that is, we believe that district courts are obligated to say that where it finds opinions or testimony of an expert relevant and reliable that goes to controverted facts, it must say why it does not overcome a summary judgment motion. There are no cases like that, principally because, and invariably so, admissibility is so high that it is that testimony should be sufficient to go to a jury. The other point is the only reason the lower court gave for the most part was regarding this point as well as other points was that it was not persuaded. Now, that is not the law of this circuit, and I don't think I need to say anything more. Trial judges do not judge credibility and persuasiveness of testimony. The conclusions of the testimony go to a trier fact, and in this case, Judge Sharp gave us a jury trial. Now, Judge Sharp pointed to cases like Sutter versus California, Gordon versus Lewistown out of Pennsylvania, Tennant and Freeman. But in all those cases, Your Honors, they were bench trials. Now, they focus in on geographic markets, but I think the point is relevant because in a bench trial, the judge, by very nature, will be judging the facts and coming to conclusions, including judging the persuasiveness of the expert opinion. That does not apply in a case where there is a jury trial.
Yes, Judge. Kind of help me here. I'm having problems with this case, but why isn't the geographic area that we'd be looking at much larger than what is defined here? For instance, Indianapolis or something. I don't know. It's not that far, really, from Lafayette to Indianapolis, so why wouldn't...
Judge Evans, I believe it probably if you were a woman about to deliver, it might be a lot farther than one might think. But to answer your question...
But there's more than OB anesthesiology services.
Well, it's inpatient surgical as well. Yeah. You have to look at where the market where, in a practical sense, driven by common sense, patients can obtain the services. And this is done through an economic analysis. And typically, we've used and others have used what's called the Olzinga-Hogarty method. And we have come up through the analysis in the record, similar to percentages found in this circuit's Rockford Memorial decision. But more importantly with respect to that is Dr. Olzinga who's a co-author of this economic analysis, said just recently, last October, in the Evanston Northwestern healthcare case, that his analysis doesn't really fit the hospital services area because it's overly broad, or prescribes an overly broad geographic market than really what is warranted. So you really have to look at an area that will be sufficient in a practical sense for patients. And Dr. Seaman has identified the one market, four market, and certainly the eight market area.
Yeah, but weren't there facilities available that were within what he defined as the market that he did not include in his study?
Yes, but they were not suitable alternatives. The 16-bed hospital where anesthesia is not practiced much, that is suggesting what you need to do in this case, and that is do a dynamic analysis. It's not enough under Elzinga-Hogarty where patients currently go, but where could they go? And we did that with an opinion that was found relevant and reliable. So, and those were not suitable alternatives. Our opponents will say they are, but then that's a question of fact. So even though there might be other facilities out there, if through a dynamic analysis, and Judge Sharp said in his Daubert order on Seaman that there was a dynamic analysis that was done. And again, if that is a finding by the lower court, it goes to admissibility, and again, admissibility is so rigorous a standard that it's sufficient to allow us to proceed to jury in this case.
Now, most of the evidence these experts relied on was anecdotal evidence relating to the incompetence on the part of anesthesiologists since June 2001. Is that correct?
Oh, no. I, quite frankly, the data, at least with respect to the markets, comes from the Indiana Hospital Association.
But that's just statistics. That doesn't deal with quality of care.
Well, now, when you suggest quality of care, you're talking about one of the prongs of harm to competition. You have to show harm to competition, either by quality of care, pricing, or availability. You only need one. We happen to have all three. But to Judge Williams, but to suggest to answer your inquiry in terms of quality, we don't have anecdotal evidence. We have live testimony from 17 witnesses, from affidavits, that members of the exclusive group left not for a minute or two to go to a washroom and take a quick break, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 45 minutes, leaving the hospital for open heart surgery, falling asleep. That's not anecdotal. That's in the record. That's testimony in terms of the quality of care. Now, our opponents would tell us, well, we haven't linked up before the contract until after the contract. Well, before the contract, except perhaps the on-call or backup coverage issue, competition allowed good quality and allowed consumer choice. But these contracts took away the quality and they took away the choice.
How common are these exclusive service contracts in the industry?
Exclusive contracts are common. In fact, they're not unlawful per se. But they can become unlawful. As Justice O'Connor said in her concurrence in Jefferson Parish.
Well, how common are they? Say if you were, I don't know if the record would tell us anything like this, but
well, I would
in
say
Indianapolis, let's say, at hospitals there, they have exclusive contracts.
Oh, I'm sure.
Provisions of anesthesia.
I'm sure, Judge Evans, that there are exclusive contracts in Indianapolis or there in Chicago. I'm not saying they're uncommon. But it's an exclusive dealing arrangement which can become unreasonable and restrain trade if they block a segment of the market. And Justice O'Connor said that in her concurrence in Jefferson Parish versus Hyde.
Was there an exclusive contract before the two hospitals merged?
Yes, by a few months. I apologize. No, the initial contract went into being in 1994. Because there was supposed to be a lack of backup or on-call coverage availability. But we see through the Tribrook report, which was produced by GLHS's consultant, paid by GLHS. Now, admittedly, The lower court did not allow it in for summary judgment purposes, but it said that unavailability is a significant factor in the OR management. That's 10 years later. These contracts didn't produce the efficiencies that were necessary, that were called for. I mean, Mr. Walling, the CEO of the hospitals, said the contracts assured performance and service. Well, availability was still an issue 10 years later. And we have record evidence, Judge Kane, as to from practitioners and nurses, as well as this official report.
I guess my question goes to whether this problem was exacerbated or created because of the merger of the two hospitals.
The only thing that the record has is that we didn't have a problem before the contracts came into being, but the telling point, Judge Kane, is that the incidences rose from 2000 going forward. The more entrenched this exclusive relationship became, the more incidences of leaving patients anesthetized, asleep, the more incidents those arose, and availability now became significant. Sometimes you had to wait for hours to days to weeks to get surgery scheduled because anesthesiologists weren't there. And then they had to hire locum tenens who didn't even know certain procedures. All this is in the record, Judge Kane. So the specific answer is, if we eliminate factors such as policies or procedures that say doctors can leave the operating room for many, many minutes at a time, or they weren't trained as well. I mean, we have to look at human nature, and I think in the HCA case, which is Judge Posner's decision, he talks about the factor of human nature. And it can become corrupt over time. These contracts were no-bid contracts, and their renewals were no-bid contracts.
Well, different laws address different harms or problems in society. And why wouldn't, let's say if a patient was receiving inadequate anesthesiology services at a hospital and suffered harm as a result of that, I would assume that that patient would file a medical malpractice lawsuit to recover damages against the hospital or the anesthesiologist or the group employing the anesthesiologist. Why is that how society protects against those such harms that you're talking about?
We aren't looking at an individual patient who has physical harm. You're right. A medical malpractice case is not an anti-competitive case. Antitrust laws, as we all know, protect competition, protect the consumer. Having a medical malpractice case is only as to one person, and indeed, that does not make an antitrust case. But what we have here is consumers' choice are limited. They've suffered injury as a result.
Yeah, but you've acknowledged that an exclusive contract is not per se improper. So why then, if the problem you're seeing here is anesthesiologist leaving the operating room or doing something like that during a surgical procedure, why isn't that addressed through a different legal mechanism like a malpractice case?
An exclusive, well, this is not a malpractice case.
I understand that.
But the exclusive dealing can become an unreasonable restraint on trade if it limits consumer choice.
Well, it would do that, wouldn't it?
No. No, because if consumers have the availability of whoever they wished, then there is no restraint on trade. But this contract in this market restrains trade because it limits choice, because there's also harm to competition defined, as Judge Williams brought up, one factor, the quality of care issue. There's also availability, which is linked in, and, of course, pricing. Pricing, we've had expert testimony found relevant and reliable as well by Dr. Paul Gertler, saying whereas there might be a baseline of 6% increase, he opined, without objection from defendants, a 13 to 26% increase, and we're not even taking into account the economic notion of quality-adjusted pricing, which Dr. Seaman testified to as well. In other words, the Daubert issues sort of are interlaced throughout all of this because Judge Sharp, in his opinions, did not find that our experts' opinions contraindicated any law of this circuit and did not support any element of the burden of proof.
The person making the choice for these anesthesiologists is the primary physician or the physician in doing the...
In this case, we have developed where the consumer wants Dr. Coker. We have record evidence. We're not; it's not isolated. As well as...
But that's, is that limited to obstetrics?
No, in general. We want Dr. Coker. There's our anesthesiologist. That's in the record. Now, Judge Kane, I agree with you that there's also record evidence of surgeons saying we want Dr. Carolyn Coker to be our anesthesiologist. So the consuming market in this case are not hospitals and where they can get anesthesiologists. It's where consumers can get their anesthesia services. A lot of cases out in the federal jurisprudence doesn't have that situation. We have developed that, and that's the element which makes the product anesthesia services in these two particular markets. So we have shown geographic market, product market, pro-competitive effects. Defendants will say what we did was pro-competitive and that trumped any adverse consequences. Well, Mr. Walling said that these contracts improved efficiencies, availabilities, and services, and cost. Mr. Everly, the subsequent CEO to GLH, says, you know, we didn't do any cost studies on the exclusive contracts. We're not talking about cost savings of the two hospitals. We're talking about the contracts themselves and whether they save money. But there weren't any studies done.
And were there any studies done by you on costs that increased outside of what you thought was the market? In other words, in other parts of Indiana, whether the relative increase in cost comparable, you know, so that the evidence the court would have would show that these increase were extraordinary when you looked at other markets?
Yes, Dr. Paul Gertler's testimony, an expert in this case, economist.
But didn't he just do, he had defined what his market was. I'm talking about a larger market in Indiana.
His research, Judge Williams, included over 1 million hospital charts, over, I think, 250 exclusive contracts in rural and urban settings. And, by the way, he could extrapolate to Lafayette, and the Seventh, this circuit allows for extrapolation. And, again, his testimony was found relevant and reliable. And the only thing that the lower court said is...
Well, remind me, because I don't recall that there was some extraordinary... Was his finding that there was some extraordinary increase in the pricing?
Well, he was asked, I believe it's through my questions in a deposition, well, what... pricing increase did you find as a result of these contracts? He said 13% to 26%. Earlier in that deposition, Judge Williams, he said baselines for these kind of contracts is about 6% increase. Dr. Seaman talked about the concept of quality-adjusted pricing, and I referred to Judge Posner's bedbug case, the Mathias versus Acorn case, where if hotel guests knew that they had bedbugs in their beds, they wouldn't pay a nickel for the room. Well, that's quality-adjusted pricing. Dr. Seaman opined at about 20%. That opinion's in the record. We have a huge increase relating to the pricing factor. I see that I'm infringing upon my rebuttal time, Your Honors, and I save 5 minutes for my rebuttal. Unless there's any other questions at this point.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Woods?
Good morning. I'm Judy Woods. I represent Anesthesiology Associates, PC. I'm going to address a number of the issues before this court, particularly the issues with respect to standing, the Daubert issues, the Section 1 antitrust issues. Mr. Pennell, who represents GLHS, will represent the market definition issues, some of the market power issues, the pro-competitive effects, the essential facilities, and the conspiracy issues. I want to remind the court that this case is very similar to a case previously decided by this court, the BCB anesthesia care case, in which the court held that a case involving an exclusive services contract very similar to the court to the case at hand involves one hospital's decisions about staffing privileges and staffing patterns. There is nothing anti-competitive about such a position by a hospital to choose a particular staffing pattern, including one based on an exclusive services contract. A hospital has an unquestioned right to do so. Mr. Zaremski just admitted that exclusive contracts are not themselves illegal per se. Of course, the United States Supreme Court in the Jefferson Parish case has clearly held that such cases are not illegal per se. Now, one of the primary issues to be addressed this morning is the relationship between the summary judgment standard and the Daubert standard. And Mr. Zaremski has said again and again that there simply is no case law, that it's virtually impossible to find precedent to show that situation that we have at hand in this case, where a district court judge decides not to exclude opinion evidence from experts on the basis of Daubert, nevertheless goes on and grants summary judgment. In fact, in the brief cited by the appellees, there are a number of cases where, in fact, that is just the case. That is exactly what happened. Part of the problem here, and you heard it this morning from Mr. Zaremski himself, is that Mr. Zaremski is attributing the relevancy standard under Daubert to say that it is relevant to a material fact. And therefore, once relevancy has been established under Daubert, there is a material fact at issue. In fact, the relevancy standard under Daubert doesn't even mention materiality. It's much broader than that. And in fact, we know from numerous cases decided under Daubert and its progeny that, in fact, an expert may opine as to many things in a case that are not material, that are not outcome determinative. And what we have here is a leaping over that critical distinction between the relevancy standard in Daubert and the sufficiency standard in a summary judgment case, particularly a case involving antitrust, where there is a long history of federal jurisprudence and Supreme Court cases that say that district court judges in antitrust cases have an even greater burden to test the sufficiency of the evidence. And that is exactly what we have here. So it is that critical misunderstanding that relevance in Daubert means materiality that has led to part of the problem here. Now, what we also have here is the difference, and something that's pointed out in the Joyner case, that relevancy means fit. Again, the appellant has attributed that to mean that once that fit is defined for purposes of the Daubert test, as the district court did in this case, that there is a material fact in dispute. It does not mean that. That is not what Joyner holds, and that is not what we have here. Now, what did the court say? The court very carefully, the district court, in at least two places in its opinion, addressed this difference. And it said, I know what I've done here. I did let these opinions in under Daubert because they did meet the relevancy. They did meet the scientific reliability test. But they are not sufficient for summary judgment. Now, the court did use the word, I'm not persuaded, but the court said it was not persuaded because the evidence was insufficient. The court did not improperly weigh the evidence.
So your position would be there was no weighing by the court. That was just... I don't know. That term was not very clear to persuade.
That's correct.
Because of the rest of the sentence.
That's correct. And because of footnote 4 later on in the opinion where the court elaborates on what it did. And I think that initial statement about persuasion is in the very first paragraph or two of the opinion. The court is kind of setting up what it's done. And the court is not using, as you say, perhaps the most precise language that it could. Now, one of the most fundamental things about this case is that the appellant lacks standing to bring this case.
Now, counsel would say that, you know, because her contract was not renewed, I think the date was in 1998 that these various activities culminated in 2001, such that there was this major antitrust problem. What's your response?
Well, let me address that sequence of events. We know that there have been exclusive contracts since 1994, that Dr. Kochert was part of those exclusive contracts at Home Hospital through March of 1998. In March of 1998, which is the precipitating event that she talks about, there was no anti-competitive behavior because at that point in time, she was still practicing the full range of anesthesia at St. Elizabeth Medical Center, less than a mile away from Home Hospital. There's absolutely no foreclosure, no anti-competitive behavior. Okay, we move on.
St. Elizabeth have an exclusive contract as well?
Yes, they do. They've had an exclusive contract since 1999 through the present. Initially, the exclusive contract was with Dr. Kochert's group. That contract extended through June of 2001. And in June of 2001, the hospital administration decided to replace that group with the AA group. And so, in other words, all we have is a reshuffling of competitors. There's absolutely no change other than that.
Well, I asked the same question. What did the merger have to do with this situation?
Well, I think that the only thing that the merger had to do with the situation is the fact that after the merger, the hospital administration wanted to recognize certain economies of scale between the two campuses. Hence, it did close the OB unit at St. Elizabeth Medical Center, and later on, it did decide to use single service providers for a number of exclusive contracts, including the anesthesia area. Now, even if we take the continuum approach, which we're not quarreling with, and we look at what happened in June of 2001, which is the final act in this continuum that Dr. Kochert points to, what is the situation with respect to competitiveness at that point in time? Okay, at that point in time, we still have the same group of physicians in Lafayette, both in LA and AA, practicing anesthesia. Now, the AA group now has the exclusive contract at both Lafayette hospitals, but within the market area that Dr. Kochert's own expert has defined, those eight counties, we have the LA doctors continuing to practice anesthesia, not only at several hospitals where they themselves hold exclusive contracts, but at other hospitals that are very close by, within less than an hour commuting distance, and which were ignored by Mr. Seaman. Mr. Seaman didn't even address the hospitals in Kokomo, in Logansport, and in Boone County, and those hospitals are closer to the center of the market area that he defines.
But counsel says that those hospitals didn't have OB-GYN-type services or something to that effect, that's what distinguished them.
I understand he said that some of those hospitals are smaller. For example, the hospital in Williamsport is a very small hospital. That's correct. But he didn't even talk about the hospitals in Logansport and Kokomo, which are fairly substantial mid-sized cities in Indiana, and those hospitals are comparable in size to St. Elizabeth Medical Center and Home Hospital. Those are hospitals that are right there. There's an OB hospital in Lebanon, Indiana, that he doesn't even talk about. It's a hospital devoted to OB care, and it's not even mentioned in his report. That is why the district court judge found Seaman's opinion insufficient to grant summary judgment because he ignored these economic realities. He took a rigid approach and said, these are the counties I'm going to look at. These are the only counties I'm going to look at. I'm not going to analyze the data from anywhere else, and I therefore conclude what the market area is. Now, we heard some issues this morning about consumer choice being foreclosed as a result of these exclusive contracts. In fact, there's only one doctor that's been foreclosed, and that's Kochert. And the test for foreclosure for anti-competitive behavior is foreclosure in a substantial portion of the market that did not occur. Kochert has not met her burden to show the legal elements under Section 1 or Section 2 of any of her claims. And therefore, as a matter of law, the district court judge was correct in granting summary judgment. I want to just say briefly, the matter of quality of care is anecdotal evidence. We have 17 multiple hearsay descriptions of a few simple events. There is no correlation that those incidents are caused by the anti-competitive behavior at issue. And that is an essential element of this case that Dr. Kokert has failed to prove. There is absolutely no basis for the quality-adjusted pricing theories of her experts, and those were rejected properly by the district court. As I said at the very beginning, this is a very simple case about a hospital choosing a particular staffing pattern that resulted in exclusion of one physician from the market. There was an increase in physicians. Quality of care did not suffer. Price was maintained at competitive levels. There were no adverse anti-competitive effects within the market defined by Dr. Kokert's expert. And therefore, the district court judge correctly found that the summary judgment burden of the plaintiff had not been met and granted summary judgment for the defendants in this case. And we would urge this court to affirm that ruling.
Maybe your co-counsel is going to get into this, but what about counsel's argument? And if he is going to get into it, you don't have to address it. This increase being so significant when you compare it to, you know, markets outside the Indiana area.
The increase in what, Your
In
Honor?
The services, the cost of the services.
Oh, the increase in the cost of the services. Well, in fact, there's a table in the record that compares the increase in the cost of the services, and the charges for anesthesia services are within $5 between the two groups all along. There are local anesthesiologists in Lafayette who have always charged more than Anesthesiology Associates, PC, and the reference that Mr. Zaremski made to Mr. Gertler's testimony had to do with the cost that hospitals charge for an overnight stay. That, Your Honor, has nothing to do with anesthesia prices. And in fact, Mr. Gertler testified in his deposition that he was giving an opinion as to what he thought the increase in overnight stay charges might be in the Lafayette hospitals, but he had never seen the contracts at issue. So, again, the district court correctly rejected that as legally insufficient.
And that chart that you made reference to, is it the – I could have just missed it. Was it in the appendix?
I do not know whether it is in the appendix. I believe it is tab 37 in the statement of facts.
Okay. Thank you.
And if that's not correct, I'll check the citation for you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel. Pinnell?
May it please the Court, I'm Steve Pennell. I represent Greater Lafayette Health Services and John Walling. There are several points that I would like to address in addition to the points addressed by Ms. Woods. First, one of the elements of an antitrust action under Section 1 or Section 2 is concerted action or conspiracy. In order to establish that there was a concerted action, the plaintiff's evidence must tend to exclude the possibility that the defendants acted independently. There's no such evidence in this case. Kokert alleges three bases for her antitrust claims. None of those claims involve concerted action. First, the decision to, not to renew Dr. Kokert's subcontract in 1998 was made exclusively by AA. GLHS had nothing to do with that decision. The other two decisions, closing the OB unit at Home Hospital and awarding the exclusive contract at St. E. in 2001, were made entirely by GLHS. And AA had no input into either one of those decisions. The only thing that AA did was to accept the contract when it was offered. And there are many, many cases involving exclusive contracts. No court has ever held that simply accepting an offer, an exclusive contract, constitutes concerted action. Regarding the product market, which has been discussed, this issue is controlled by this court's holding, the Seventh Circuit's holding, in the Collins case. And when you analyze Collins, there were two parts of the decision. The first part dealt with the Tyne allegation. And the court in Collins looked at whether or not there had been a request for the doctor's services, so there hadn't been, so there was no tied product. But in part four of the decision, which is what we're talking about here, The court said that on the restraint of trade issue, the product market is anesthesia or is pathologist, because the court was dealing with an exclusive contract. And the court said, quote, the relevant product here is pathologists, not pathology services, and the corresponding market is the market in which pathologists compete for jobs, not the market in which hospitals compete in offering pathology services to patients. That's the same thing we have here, because we're dealing with an exclusive services contract. If the contract were terminated, GLHS would have to go out into the market and retain or hire new anesthesiologists to fulfill the contract. And that is a national market. Indeed, one of Kochert's own experts, Dr. Ivankovich, holds an exclusive contract at his hospital. And what he does is he then subcontracts with other doctors, and he recruits from Alaska to Florida. Well, that is a national market.
Let me ask you this. GLHS gets no economic benefit from the AA sales. Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct.
Go ahead.
Yes. AA bills for its own services,
right. Does
its own billing, collects its own fees. It does not share those fees with GLHS. So there is no economic benefit here other than the direct indirect economic benefit of having a hospital where you have surgeries and have anesthesiologists. But there is no direct economic benefit. All right. If one were to consider the product market as being anesthesiology services, as Kochert does, there are two reasons why her argument fails. And the district court addressed both of those in its opinion. There's been a lot of talk about suitability. I'd like to address that. What the district court found was that Kochert's analysis ignored the commercial realities of the market in Lafayette. In order to determine the geographic market, one must determine whether hospitals would be reasonable substitutes so they could act as a constraint on any exercise of market power. What did Dr. Seaman do? In Table 2 of his report, which is the only place that you'll find any comparison of the hospitals, he identifies four hospitals. And those are the four hospitals that are in the county surrounding Lafayette. What Mr. Seaman then does is he says, or he assumes, that none of those hospitals are suitable constraints because he assumes that they have poor quality. He says that's his hypothesis. He doesn't know that. He doesn't test his hypothesis. He does no investigation into the facts to determine if they're poor substitutes. But he assumes that as a hypothetical. And then when we ask why he assumes that, he says, well, it's just not my burden of proof. So he doesn't do anything more except to assume that these four hospitals are poor substitutes. But what about the other hospitals? In Seaman's report in paragraphs 26 and 27, he notes in addition to the four hospitals in the county surrounding Lafayette, there are 25 other hospitals which are within a 60-mile radius or about a one-hour drive from Lafayette. And those hospitals include, again, according to Seaman, 16 hospitals in Marion County, 3 hospitals in Hamilton County, 1 hospital in Cass County, 1 hospital in Jasper, and 1 county in Boone. These 25 hospitals are local. These hospitals are located as close, if not closer, to as many of the people or to the people in what Seaman defines as the geographic market. Seaman doesn't do anything to consider whether these hospitals are suitable. Why not? Kochert states in her reply brief at page 18, that Seaman did not consider these 25 hospitals as reasonable alternatives simply because they were outside what he defined as the geographic market. That doesn't mean they're not suitable. In fact, the evidence shows that they are already in competition. Already, 13% of the people who live in Tippecanoe County go to the hospitals in Marion County for their hospital needs. Of the three most populous counties in what Seaman defines as the geographic market, Tippecanoe, Montgomery, and Clinton, about 24% of these people already go to hospitals in Marion County. The hospitals in Marion County are some of the largest hospitals in Indiana. They have the best physicians, the best staff, the state-of-the-art equipment. No one can say that these hospitals are not suitable alternatives, and we know because the data already shows these hospitals are already in direct competition with Lafayette and GLHS. As the court in Tenet noted, a contrived market which stops just short of including hospitals that are just outside the proposed geographic market, quote, strikes us as absurd, end quote. Yet that is exactly what Mr. Seaman did in ignoring these other 25 hospitals. I would also note that there are few barriers to entry in the market. Arnett Clinic is already planning to build a new hospital in Lafayette. They've announced that they have teamed with Clarion Hospital from Indianapolis to build a 150-bed, $170 million hospital, which is scheduled to open in 2008. clearly there is competition in this market. I would also note that there are pro-competitive objectives.
How does Unity outpatient figure into this situation? As far as competition with the
Currently, Unity and GLHS have partnered up so that GLHS has now purchased some of the Unity assets, and the Unity doctors are performing outpatient services not only at their own facility, but also at GLHS. So there is no harm to competition. They're already working together to provide services to the market. Regarding the pro-competitive objectives, the decision to consolidate the units certainly served pro-competitive objectives, legitimate business objectives. There were over 2,000 deliveries at Home Hospital in 1997 and 1998. There were only about 400 at St. E. That was inefficient. Home Hospital has a neonatal unit. St. E. does not. Having the neonatal unit at Home Hospital improves patient safety. It also resulted in millions of dollars in savings. GLHS saved $493,000 in 1999 and has saved more than $640,000 each year thereafter. Those are legitimate reasons to consolidate those units. The exclusive services contract also served legitimate business purposes. Again, the GLHS awarded exclusive contracts not only to anesthesiologists, but also to the other patient physician groups at GLHS, including radiology, pathology, and emergency care physicians. Why? Because it improves accountability, it improves working relationships, it's more efficient. These contracts can be terminated on either 90 days notice. These contracts are limited in duration for a period of 2 to 3 years. In the cases of health, these are all serve legitimate business objectives. Finally, with the issue of essential facility, Cochrane's essential facility claim fails for two reasons. Number one, she's not a competitor of GLHS. And number two, GLHS is not an essential facility. And again, this is, I think, the key to the whole case. Physicians have not been foreclosed from practicing anesthesiology, even with the market defined by Siemens. The LA physicians and the other anesthesiologists are still providing care to patients within what even Siemens defined as a limited geographic market. Patients still have a choice. If any patient were dissatisfied with the quality of care at GLHS, that patient will be free to go to St. Clair Hospital in Crawfordsville or up to Logansport or over to Kokomo or any place else. And again, for most people, those hospitals are as close to where they live and work as GLHS. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bell. How much time?
1.5.
Yeah, 1.5 minutes left in your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Number one, Mr. Everly has testified that there is economic benefit to GLHS through the exclusive contracts. Number two, Collins does not stand for the proposition that Mr. Pennell has just indicated.
So what is the direct economic benefit when there's separate billing?
There's an economic benefit to GLHS by having these contracts so that GLHS can therefore acquire better third-party payer arrangements as a result of the limits placed on these contracts. That is direct testimony from Mr. Everly. Dr. Coker, well, I see my...
No, you have another minute.
Okay, sorry. Dr. Coker has standing. She is ready, willing, and able to participate in anesthesiology, even with letters through Mr. Everly, but she has been precluded. But what it all comes down to, Your Honors, is the fact that the lower court found the testimony on all the central issues admitted through the Daubert process, and everything that has been raised today always comes back to the Daubert decisions. And the fact is that the only reason given why summary judgment was granted in general, Your Honors, was that the lower court was not persuaded by the conclusions.
So then if we were to disagree with you and agree with the district court, since everything is tied with Daubert, you would lose on every claim.
Well, this court, and if I can finish my response, this court would have to say that Judge Sharp committed manifest error, because that's the deferential standard that this circuit has to judge what he did, other than whether or not he followed the Daubert framework, which is de novo. So this court must acquiesce to the lower court unless it finds manifest error in what was done. I suspect after 2 days of oral arguments, a couple hundred pages of pleadings, including a law review style briefs we all had to do on this circuit's Daubert rulings, that in effect the framework was followed in spades, and that was the de novo review. But the standard to judge then whether there was error is a deferential one, and that is whether there's manifest error in the record in what the lower court did. Your Honors, thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.